job for you to be advisors on a movie?
Actually not. I got into the movie business. This is my third film as an advisor. I worked on Apollo 13, the film, and I was asked to do that because I had been a flight director in Mission Control for the real Apollo 13, the Ed Harris character. And that led to me being asked to work on Contact, and it was just a word of mouth thing. And then Joan Bradshaw, who is the executive producer of this film, was also the executive producer of Contact. So when she moved over here, she said, I got another one for you if you want to do this one. I'm not retired. I left NASA about 10 years ago, but I've got a zillion things I'm doing, and so I'm kind of shoehorning this career into all the other things I do. But it's fascinating. I've really changed my view of Hollywood. Found that people are hardworking. They're dedicated to doing it right. The films I've worked on, those three, Apollo 13, Contact, and this one, the production people and director really pushed hard to make everything as accurate as they could, to the extent that they could, and there had to be trade-offs. But Mimi on this film said, look, you see anything you don't like, you tell me. One thing I've learned too, I've probably spent a third of my time script review and script editing and script comments. Techno talk that astronauts do and mission control centers do is kind of foreign language. So it's easier in many cases for me just to sit down and write a sequence of that techno speak, mm-hmm. and rather than having trying to get that across to a writer, and the writers don't mind, the writers soon get that point, say, just take that and write it. The other thing that is kind of fun about this is that I had a small part in Contact, and I had a small part in this movie, and it's almost cameo in this one, but I had more lines in Contact, so I actually got in front of the camera a little bit, which is kind of a hoot. So that was fun.
What were you doing on the Apollo mission, Apollo 13?
I was a flight director in Mission Control. And a flight director is the one that runs the room. If you look at Ed Harris in Apollo 13, he was a composite of actually the three of us, because that flight went on after the explosion for 4.5 days. And if you look at the movie carefully, he was kind of there the whole time. Well, nobody did that. Had to get some sleep. The other thing, the interesting thing about what I have done in this film, is that I find that there are some parallels between making a motion picture and the NASA experience. It's a big group of people with a lot of moving parts that have to come down to a common goal. One is called a successful space flight, one's called a movie. But the people are driven, they work extremely hard. Gosh, that's what really gets me is, you know, these people don't have a life while they're making a movie. I mean, it's dawn till late at night, and I probably spent 7 weeks or so spread out over 3.5-4 months during the shooting, either on location or in California. And I was exhausted when it was finished.
And then the editing and looping.
I've been involved in looping and looping sound, you know, after the film and all that. So it's a fascinating process. And the technology, there's some other similarities there, is that the technology of today in the motion picture industry is a little scary. It's so good. I mean, the computer graphics and all that they can put together. But there's nothing low-tech about making a movie anymore. It's very high-tech stuff. And that, again, is kind of similar to the NASA experience.
Since no one ever landed on a comet, how did you imagine this?
Well, there's some things we know about it. Yeah, there's some things we know about a comet. We know that it's very low gravity, and that's why, as you see, you don't really land so much on a comet as you fly formation with it and grab onto it. And that's why we fired the pitons into the icy surface to hold ourselves against it. And also, if you'll notice some of the small points in the film, they actually are tethered when they're working on the surface with the drills and all that stuff. They're actually tethered to the surface. There's a piton or a stake driven into the ice, and they're actually tethered to it. The only time they're untethered is when they're getting back, when they're running back to get into the cargo bay, and we just couldn't keep them tethered that whole time. Comet is very low gravity, so it's hard to operate on. It's very nearly like weightlessness. It's got just a little bit of gravity. And on a very small comet, you could literally jump off of it. You could jump into orbit. So you'd have to be very, very careful, move very slowly. You'd probably use a series of tethers like a rock climber or a mountain climber would do to stay connected. Make sure if you drifted off, you could put yourself back down. Comets are very active. They are made mostly of ice and dirt, dirty ice. And when they get close to the sun, they heat. And when they heat, they vent because they create steam. And that's what you see in a comet's tail, is that called a coma, which is it's the debris that's blown out by these vents. And all. So the best shots we've got of a comet only has a resolution of like the size of a football field. So we don't know a lot about what they look like up close. I think the set designers and all did a great job of taking inputs from a lot of people and came up with a surface that could be a comet. In the absence of anybody else ever seeing one.
You're happy with it.
Well, I'm happy with it. Comet experts will tell you that the only place we probably missed it, it's probably slightly lighter than a real comet surface. They say that a real comet surface is very dark, almost like a coal color. It's that much dirt in the ice. And though we couldn't do that because you couldn't see anything, and so we had to make it a little lighter.
It's a movie.
Yeah, it's a movie. Let's make
there's some lights on the spacecraft.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. So, but all of the technical aspects of the movie, I was really happy with. They listened carefully and did everything they possibly could to make the real parts as real as they could.
Did the Armageddon people want to work on their movie?
I got a contact. I was already working on Deep Impact by then, so I was already engaged and I couldn't do it. But I got a feeler from another technical advisor, a friend of mine who did a little bit of work for him. But I couldn't do it. I had to be two places at once.
Were you when you started out? You were an astronaut.
No, I was in mission control the whole time.
No.
Yeah, and I came back after the Apollo program. I went off and did some other things for NASA. I went to NASA headquarters, and then I was the deputy director at our facility at Edwards Air Force Base in California. Then I was moved back to the Cape as deputy director of that center, and then in 1982 I went back to Johnson Space Center in Houston as the director of the entire place, and that's what I was doing when I took early retirement in about 10 years ago.
And what was your training?
I was an aero major, an aeronautical engineer. I had a little bit of grad school, business school right after I got out, but I never did get my MBA. But I flew in the Air Force before I was commissioned out of college, and flew in the Air Force and then got into the space business. As soon as Al Shepard took his first suborbital flight, I said, that's what I want to go do. And in those days, you had to be a test pilot in order to be an astronaut, so that was out because I wasn't a test pilot.
Have you ever thought you'd see the day when space travel became so blasé that the American people...
It's an interesting point, and the reason that I think we've gotten to where we've gotten is it's a little bit like two things. It's a little... We're a victim of our success, but it's not unlike the airplane. You know, remember when the airplane was first developed, there were barnstormers, and people would come from all over to go see an airplane fly. And even later, people would just watch airplanes. They were just fascinated by them. But now there's a commonplace. It became a kind of a tour. I'm going to go get one this afternoon, fly back to Texas. And it was just like sitting in my office. So I think it was inevitable. I think it had to kind of take a place in the American or even the international minds that, yeah, it's there. People forget that they communicate satellites and they get their weather from the satellites, and more disaster warnings are becoming capable of satellite, using satellite technology. And I think until we do take another bold step like the lunar program, if we go to Mars, we'll get people interested. And I think we will go to Mars, and we'll do it next century. I don't know when, but sometime in the next century we'll go to Mars. Then I think people will get highly interested again. And but you got to have a lot of factors line up in order to do a Mars mission, for instance. Neil Armstrong tells a story. We met shortly after Apollo finished, and a group of us were kind of trying to do a little bit of a retreat on what did we just do for the last 10 years and how are we able to pull it off. And so we contemplated our navels there for a few days. But Neil finally got up and he drew four curves on a blackboard, and he had them with peaks like this, and he had them displaced. And he labeled one of them bold leadership. He labeled one world peace. He labeled one financially healthy. And I can't remember what the fourth, there were four of them. And he said, the only reason we were able to do Apollo is because all of those curves peaked at the same time. Where we had bold leadership, and we were financially healthy, and we didn't have any shooting wars going on. And we had the infrastructure, we had the technology in hand to do it. And when all of those come together, oh, I know another one he had was threat. A threat. And this, in the case of the lunar thing, it was the Soviets. And the threats, he pointed out, could come in all kinds of forms. It could be economic, it could be food chain, at risk. It could be all kinds of. So he said, until those things all get in combination again and peak at the same time, we're not going to go to Mars. And the only reason we were able to do Apollo is because they did. So he said, we got to be ready.
And it wasn't a narrow kind of time.
It was. It all came together, and everything was right. And so when it was right, it happened. And I tell the NASA people today that are kind of like you were saying, a little bit maybe disenchanted that they aren't getting more support and all that. No, I said, you've got to be ready for when this next thing comes together, we'll go to Mars. And it'll be for a good, solid reason, and you'll have the will of the people to do it.
Do you think the current NASA program on Mars with, faster, cheaper, better than the Pathfinder, and then publicity the Pathfinder got when it did land, and people were riveted by the images?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and I think you're exactly right. I think Pathfinder captured everybody, seeing that little guy running around and taking pictures and all that. And I suspect the next thing we'll do is probably return a sample from Mars, and you actually get some Martian soil. I do think that those early robotic flights are important, but they don't answer the final will of the human to explore. And if you explore, Lewis and Clark didn't send empty canoes out west. They were there to describe and find and to open up that vista. So I really think ultimately, in order to satisfy the human need to explore, you'll send men to Mars. People.
What do you think of John Glenn doing that?
Oh, I think it's great. John is will be 77 years old. I think it's great, not necessarily from John's personal standpoint. I mean, the reason he's going is because he's a Democrat senator in a Democrat administration. I mean, if he was Republican, he probably wouldn't go. But I think it's good to fly an older citizen. I think I've said all along, I like the idea I left the agency right before Krista McCullough, the teacher, got killed on Challenger. And I knew her very well. But I think it's important that we fly journalists, writers, poets, older people, younger people, and I think that it's again kind of like opening up the America West, American West. We had to send lawyers and teachers, and some of them didn't make it. Some of them got wiped out in the Missouri River or the Mississippi or somewhere. But that didn't stop us. We just kept going. And I don't think we could let the McAuliffe experience stop us either. John is a good selection because he's a good first step for an older person to fly, because he's never really left the world of technology. He flies, he's on an airplane. He commuted back and forth to Ohio when he was a senator in his own airplane. Never flew commercial unless he, I guess, just had to or something. He's in great shape. He's been there. He knows what weightlessness is like, at least like it was for the short period he was in it, only 3 orbits. But at least he's been there. So I think it's a good selection of somebody to go do that. But mainly for the, what I'd call the softer reasons, not the technological reasons. It's just that we need to open space up to everybody. And I'm glad to see it.
Do you have another movie coming up?
There is one that is in pre-production. It's not cast. That I've been talked to about. It involves, and I got to understand a little more about the script, but it involves terrorists taking over the Cape, or not taking over, but infiltrating the Cape, and by doing so, actually eventually infiltrate the space station, which is the vehicle that we'll be launching, the station that will start launching next year. So this is future time frame. And the story then is, how do they get them out? How do they get them out of the, how do they back them out of this dominant position they get into? And they're using the space station for purposes it was not intended to. But, you know, this is an idea right now, so I don't know whether it's going to turn into a movie or not. But that's one I've been talked to about.
You seem to enjoy that.
Oh, I like that. Like I say, it's tremendous fun. I've got other things I do. I don't have sometimes all the free board of time I'd like to have, but I have really been fascinated with this industry. You know, it's funny, the guys in the industry want to talk to me about space program, but I want to talk to them about, how did you do that? You know, how do you make this happen? Or how did you build that set? The process to me. And I guess that's my engineering. Yeah, it's my engineering background or something. It just fascinates me. And the computer, the ILM people, the computer capability nowadays. You know, that old subject, the camera doesn't lie. That's not true anymore. I mean, they can put on that. With computers, they can make that camera just about show anything they want to.
So you have to be amazing.
That's right. That's right. So, it's a fun business.
From Earth to the Moon now?
I did by telephone, and that was all done down at Disney in Orlando. And most of it was done while I was in California on this film. And they wanted me to come down, but I just could not. And Tom, I talked to Tom a couple of times about questions he had. We did get one of the Apollo 13 advisors, a former astronaut named Dave Scott, who lives in California, spent 4 or 5 months full time in Florida. And so we did have, he had some really good help. But then Dave Scott would have to call me, because he was an astronaut, wasn't in mission control, and he said, how did you guys do so-and-so and so-and-so? So I'd just tell him on the phone. And I was telling somebody I was busy. I've got several businesses I play in, and banking, and I chair the board of a public company that makes wireless products, wireless communications products. In the month of September, my cell phone bill, it was when we were filming this, was $1,888. I was literally conducting business between takes. and some of it was with Earth to the Moon. They would call me and ask me a question, and I'd say, you'll have to wait a minute, and we'll go do a tape, and then I'd run outside and fire up my cell phone, and of course all of it was roaming charges, and the Texas cell phone. I was doing business in California, long distance charges, $1,888, broke the bank. But that, it's Earth to the Moon, I think, is well done. I've seen all six segments, and I'm really, it's like reliving that program again. It really is.
In this film, did you feel there were any technical points that were not so much gotten wrong, but glossed over to make it simpler for?
Yeah, I guess the one that sticks out mostly, I've rationalized it myself, it was the Messiah kind of disappeared. That would be a big multi-year development. And what I convinced myself was that that's really the Mission to Mars vehicle. We were going to use that vehicle. We built it for the purpose of going to Mars. And when this comet came up, they said, nope, we've got to stop the Mars mission. We're going to use that vehicle. It's the only one we got of any size. It's got the propulsion capability, blah, blah, blah. And it happens to be manned. But that's all we've got. If you had time and you were going to devise a system, it would be unmanned. It'd probably be big missiles with big bombs and a lot of them. So, but to me, and I brought this up to Mimi, that maybe we could use that premise that it was a Mars mission that we just diverted. And at that time, the movie was getting pretty long. She knew it was going to run long, and she just didn't have the time to develop that piece of the story. So not too many people will notice that, but that's probably the one that was, if something comes to mind that we just had to bypass, that was it. Where'd that vehicle come from? That's probably a 10-year development.
That's one last question. Is NASA thinking at all in terms of what would happen if some cataclysm like this was on the road?
There have been some. It's not so much NASA, it's the governmental. There have been some, what I'd call not much more than, and this is probably not fair, but back of the envelope studies. But they're very thin reports, and it's just kind of a, what's the threat? The threat's very low. It's very rare. Doesn't happen often. I think they probably could be. Maybe this movie will even provoke it. But, you know, a little study, not so much to throw tons of money at it. That's not the answer, because it is a rare occasion. But there probably ought to be a little spin on what could we do? You know, what could we do in terms of either diverting it, or what could we do to deal with it if it happens? And the second part of that is not much if it really happened. There's not a lot you can do. But I think we probably should kind of assess our resources, not only now but in the future, and say, what could we do to deal with one of these? And, if this meteor asteroid, that the false alarm that we got here a month or two ago, which was 30 years away, if that had not turned out to be a false alarm, that would have been a real interest. Now, what could we do to stop that diverted, which is what you want to do. You probably can't blow it up. You probably want to shove it to the side, like the movie.
Who would you send up to lead the mission?
Oh,
like Robert Duvall.
Oh, right.
One of the older fellows. Like,
no, I'd probably go. I'd probably want one of the young guys that knows all the recent tricks.